This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Senator Mary Landrieu tells the president no levies, no appointments, and the Department of Homeland Security opens a faith-based office to reach out to churches. Joining us today from our New York bureau, E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. And from Nashville, Tennessee, Jeff Obafemi-Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Welcome, and let's start with Cynthia McKenna. She says it's much ado about a hairdo. ER, what do you think?
That's what I think to start with. I think it's not much ado about a hairdo. Racial profiling is a very, very serious topic. In fact, a friend of mine was perhaps a victim of that just a couple of days ago in New York City. But it sounds to me that what's going on in D.C. is a combination, perhaps, of mistaken identity and all of that, and a little bit of the diva going on. Because if Ms. McKinney wanted to correct the error, she could have identified herself, and there would not have been this big issue that she acknowledges is distracting attention away from serious issues.
Michael, diva or angry black woman syndrome or any other series of names you might want to apply to it. This is playing out in a very intense way on TV in a week where you would think there would be a lot of other news. Why so much attention?
I don't want to engage in calumny, name calling with respect to the congresswoman, but I will give a word of description. This was a hair-raising incident.
He did not say that.
That interview, it was unbelievable. A congresswoman who wants to talk candidly and frankly has to come on NPR with two lawyers. I think it's outrageously unbelievable. Look, I said it a couple of days ago. She's back. This is Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. My question to her will it be, were you wearing your congressional pin?
And did you hit the person?
she wasn't wearing her pin. She says that. But as she pointed out,
there's only
14 black women in Congress. I mean, you know, how hard
is it
to...
But there are maids and there are secretaries and there's other people going through. So truthfully, I hope we don't waste a round table on this.
Yes.
But she could have, after the first encounter, said, I'm Representative McKinney from Georgia. And they would have looked her up if they didn't recognize her face or something.
And they would have said, sorry.
Well, Jeff, I do want to drill down one last thing before we move on to other topics. Why is this blanketing the media in a week filled with political news about lobbyist Jack Abramoff, corruption scandals, Tom DeLay? Why is this wall to wall?
Well, Cynthia McKinney is a very, very popular figure. She's a polarizing figure, and she's got that it, and if you want to call it divadom, if you want to call it that sister girl kind of nature that makes her both popular on one end and a target on the other, and that's why people are drawn to her personality. I think she makes a point when she says that the pages have to know who the members of Congress are and Social Security, but because the Chinese say no investigation, no speech, I wasn't there, so I can't really comment on what exactly happened. But she brings a lot of flavor to the table, and you just have to take the bitter with the sweet, and we'll see how it shakes out.
Apparently she can't comment either. Yes, still she comes on radio to comment.
All right, we're going to move on to Senator Mary Landrieu, another member of Congress. She says she's going to block the presidential appointments until the president gets Congress to pony up the money for needed levee repairs in her home state. Michael, is this a strategy that's going to work? She also threatens unspecified other actions if this doesn't work.
Mary, quite contrary. It could work. She's playing hardball, and I think somebody should play hardball with respect to getting those levies finally fixed. The time is taking too long. But this is what they call senatorial courtesy. She can only hold up the nominees from her state, and she can only do that to the extent that the rest of her colleagues respect senatorial courtesy. And in these times, when people are playing hardball on every end, I don't know if she will be able to hold her colleagues. I mean, Howard Dean can't even hold his colleagues in the Democratic Party. So I just think that it's time that people step up to the plate and say, look, get the levies fixed. Whatever we have to do to get them fixed, get them fixed.
But her strategy is just the latest episode of various people grandstanding on the whole post-Katrina thing. We've got people threatening all kinds of things. We've got people making announcements, starting with the mayor. Come on back to New Orleans, build your house. We don't guarantee it's going to be there long, but come and build your house. Anyway, get some publicity. We've got the elections coming up, and most black people who have been dispersed can't vote. So we've got people showing up to grandstand on that issue. So this is just, she's just the last one online. I don't think her strategy is going to be necessarily effective, but it's getting her some play.
Jeff, what needs to happen down there?
Well, I think everybody agrees that they need to rebuild the levees, but I think we have a couple of things operating here. On one level, this move is representative of the frustration and desperation that's being experienced by residents of the area. And for once, the senator is trying to do something radical by simply doing her job, which is leading by being a representative of the people. Last night I was in the hospital visiting this really sweet lady who was a Katrina evacuee. She's got pneumonia. And it was so disheartening to see the pain in her body and her eyes because of what she not only suffered through during the time when she had to wade in the water, but what she's battled since, having the government treat her kind of like a motherless child. So residents are desperate for federal assurances of priority and safety, and they deserve those. On the other level, I don't know that this is going to be an effective strategy in any way other than a public relations sense, which may be enough. The administration has demonstrated time and again, whether with the Iraq war or the wiretapping issue, that logic, public opinion, or just plain common sense has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on its process once it decides the direction it wants to go in.
But Jeff, with this president being as weakened as he is, she will get more play. Sorry. With this president being as weakened as he is in opinion polls, she will get a lot more play on this issue than normal, I think.
Well, Jeff, let me continue. You sort of talk about strategy in dealing with Katrina. There's another White House strategy. It's going to have an additional office to liaison with faith-based initiatives in the Department of Homeland Security, saying that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, religious institutions should be in the forefront. They should be, as one official put it, not candy stripers, but foot soldiers. Is this a good idea?
I think it's a good idea for people to be foot soldiers, and I know ER's got an opinion on it, so I'll say this quick. This is scary.
Michael has an opinion on
it. Michael, I know Michael, but this is kind of scary when we talk about this home security faith-based office, and I say that from a ministerial perspective. I'm just one guy who spent a lot of time around a lot of churches, but I'll tell you something. It's dangerous because it's contradictory to one of the fundamental messages of the church, which is render unto Caesar that which is Caesar and unto God which is God's. Churches are admonished to look out for the poor, disenfranchised, and underserved because it's a part of being a member of the godly body of people. Theologian Howard Thurman talks about the clear distinction between the religion of Jesus and modern Christianity, and that comes into discussion. With the former, you reach into yourself and sacrifice to help your man, fellow man, without judgment or proselytizing or help from the government. With the latter, there's developed a system where the church is in bed with Caesar and seeking money from Caesar to do what it's just supposed to be doing itself. So I think it's dangerous. I think it's lazy, irresponsible government. I think it's lazy, irresponsible church.
I challenge you on that one. I think it's taking fear of the Lord a little too far. The people who are going to be in need of some of these services are often people who are going to be a part of the faith-based community anyway. It's not as if you're coercing people necessarily who are not willing to be engaged in that process. But that's not to say that the churches can't do what many churches are doing these days. That is to separate the religious part of their responsibility from the community service part that will allow them to take grants from government, from foundations, from development companies. So I think we're being a little too hysterical in thinking that this is a road to hell.
Well, I think that when government gets entangled with religion, it's taking the name of the Lord in vain. It is very similar to that situation in New York where we actually pay prison, the government pays chaplains to be chap ministers to the prisoners. And why would any minister in his or her right mind want to be within or under the command influence of a government official? And as we saw in New York, when they stepped out of line and engaged in quote-unquote free speech, the government slapped them and suspended them and had the right to even fire them. So why would we have an office of faith-based community initiative. When you do that, you put the possibility of favoritism, affirmative action by government for religion. This is outrageous.
But it's not
outrageous.
It's not dealing with the religion part of this.
These, how do you know?
These institutions, you know? I have faith. These institutions.
Oh, and I'm me of little faith.
These
open
institutions
those books.
Have always been the center for community life. So it's only logical that in cases of major disasters that people would turn to these centers of community life.
But ER, one of the criticisms of this potential plan is that in order to receive aid, people who may not be of the same faith as the churches or institutions distributing it would be proselytized to in the course of getting the aid. Does that concern you?
It concerns me, but that should be part of the contractual arrangement between Homeland Security and the institution. What the roles are between the governmental side and the religion
meaning
side.
Meaning you want government actually to monitor religion and to and have churches open their books so that they can make sure that they're not doing religious proselytizing. This is entanglement. We ought to have a separation of church and state. My problem is that too many of our politicians have become preachers and too many of our preachers have become politicians.
Hey, our preachers have always been politicians.
I'll agree with Michael on that. And I'll say that, you know, last year the $2.1 billion went toward these faith-based initiatives. I'm wary of the government when they say they want to push this money into faith-based initiatives. And I'm wary of any church or organization that goes after this money because they're supposed to be doing this kind of thing, reaching out to mankind, because
yes.
It's part of what you do in church.
Humankind.
You don't look for somebody to pay for that for you. You pull it out of your own pocket. Homeless feedings. People talk about homeless feedings and outreach. And believe me, I've been involved in and around missions. And I got criticized when somebody homeless and hungry came up and wanted something to eat. I got criticized for not pounding the gospel into them. And I said, this is a shame, man. Somebody who is homeless or hungry, they need shelter and they need food. And if you do that, then eventually they might want to know more about you. But I'm confused. I think it's hurtful when you set up a situation where people can be forced to listen to a particular faith kind of understanding of the world in order to get something to eat. I think that's totally contradictory to the message, and I think it can go unchecked because there's not a regulatory authority that's set up in the government to take care of these faith-based initiatives, and I think it's dangerous to put one together.
I just want to transition us, actually. Okay. We got a couple more quick topics. We've done politics. We've done, faith-based, and now we're moving on to sex, always a good topic. This is about
After the Lord, we're going to sex?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
In the April issue of Pediatrics, there's a study that tracks teenagers and says that if teens watch movies, TV shows, listen to music and magazines that have high sexual content, white teens are 2.2 times more likely to have had intercourses at ages 14 to 16 than youngsters who didn't watch a lot of sexual media. And, of course, this is the twist. They say the effect was not as pronounced for blacks because the black youngsters had already had more sexual experience than the whites. Gosh, that's a strange conclusion. Who's going to jump in on that? Somebody save me.
I'll jump in. Michael Myers will jump in. And I'll say, look, Puritanism is dead. Puritanism is passé. Puritanism is dysfunctional. And a lot of kids know more about sex than adults. I mean, I had too many adults saying that sex is dirty. The kid will respond, yes, sex is dirty if you're doing it right. Look, media, there's all kinds of media. There's TV, and there's DVDs, and there's DVRs, and there's music, and it's all sex. I look at the children's, so-called children's programming, Edgewood and Degrassi High and Edgemont and The Tribe. Guess what? They're pushing sex. It's not about acne anymore or teenage
angst. But should
angst.
There be some, I mean, you're saying that the ship has sailed, but I mean, if this is really causing kids to have, I mean, if you live long enough, you'll have plenty of opportunities to have sex. Couldn't you just wait a little while?
No.
That's what some parents might. No, don't
no.
wait.
Parents don't want to talk about sex anymore. And sometimes in the black community, we have the same issues when we talk about discrimination of women, abuse of women in the home and domestic violence, homosexuality, whatever it is. We believe that if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. So what happens is kids end up finding out about things like this from other kids and from the radio and from TV, and they end up going, it just goes unchecked. So I think that we have a responsibility as parents to just start being frank with our kids, because our kids are being frank with each other and the world's being frank with them.
And they're being frank with each other, often passing on incorrect information to what exactly constitutes sex, for example, is one of those questions that's been on the table or under the...
That goes back to Bill Clinton.
Under the desk since Bill Clinton I was going to say. But in any case, I think you're right. There needs to be more frank talk. And that, again, is something that our community leaders, our community centers should also be involved in, because we can't presume, given the nature of dysfunctional family life, that parents are going to be the people with the right information to pass on to kids. Yeah. So there needs to be this village raising the child thing going on.
But you need sex education. And guess what you also need on TV? You need advertising and public service announcements about condoms and how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. We've got to teach children the reality and the truth of things.
Well, I just have to mention that this administration, this presidential administration, has removed a lot of information about condoms. So you're saying that the government...
They're faith-based.
All right.
They're religious.
They prefer to teach people abstinence, which is nothing wrong with it, but teaching people that... The ogre isn't in the room doesn't remove the threat of the ogre hurting them. Pretending that it's not there. So you've got to come up with a comprehensive strategy across the board to deal with that, and that's through education. You show people that you protect yourself when you go into a certain environment. That doesn't mean that you endorse that environment.
Right.
That just means that you prepare your kids for the world out there. If you don't prepare your kids, believe me, there's somebody out there that's going to bring them the incorrect information.
That's
all right, we're going to have to leave it there. Good place to leave it.
Good
from Nashville, Tennessee, Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle in the New York Bureau, E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Thanks, as always.
Thanks,
yes.
Thank you.